Chapter 4. Lily. A year before the arrival of Chet, back when my beautiful orange cat Bess was still alive, I found her one morning trapped against the vegetable garden fence by a huge, matted black stray. Bess was hissing, her fur ruffled, but she was clearly in retreat. I watched as the feral tomcat leaped onto her back, sinking his claws into Bess's haunches. I know that cats don't really scream, but that is the only way I can describe the sound that Bess made. An almost human scream of terror. I charged forward, clapping my hands, and the stray tore off. I took Bess back into the house and searched her fur for blood. There wasn't any, but I knew that the horrible cat would be back. "Just keep Bess inside," my mother said. I tried, but Bess cried at the door, and it was a semester during which my father was hosting his senior seminar at our house. Students came and went Tuesday and Thursday nights, swinging through the front door to smoke cigarettes on our steps, and Bess could easily escape. It was spring and starting to get warm, and I slept with my window cracked. One morning, just past dawn, I heard Bess yowling outside, a ferocious, terrified sound. I pulled on sneakers and ran downstairs, exiting out toward the back garden. In the gray, early morning light, I spotted them right away. Bess backed against the fence again, the horrible black stray crouched and ready to attack. They were each frozen in the terrible moment, like a diorama at the Museum of Natural History. I clapped my hands together, yelling, and the stray merely turned its ugly matted head my way, appraised me with indifference, and turned back to Bess. I knew right then that the feral Tom would kill Bess if he got a chance. Maybe not on that morning, but some morning, and that I would do anything to stop that from happening. There was a pile of paving stones on the edge of our unfinished patio. They had been there so long that moss had grown on some of them. I picked up the largest one I could carry. Its edges were sharp and it was slippery with dew. I walked quietly and quickly to stand behind the stray. I didn't need to be quiet. He was unafraid of me, intent on terrorizing Bess. Without thinking about it, I lifted the paving stone above my head and hurled it down onto him as hard as I could. He turned his head at the last moment and made a squalling sound as the edge of the stone caught him on the skull, the whole stone coming to rest on his body. Bess bolted, racing across the backyard as fast as I'd ever seen her move. The stray's body shivered, then lay still. I turned to the house, expecting to see a bedroom light turn on. The house woken by the sound of murder, but there had hardly been any sound. It had been easy. The bulkhead to the basement was unlocked. I crept down the dark, leaf-slicked steps and groped around the entryway, finding one of the snow shovels that lined the wall. I used the edge of the plastic shovel to slip the paving stone off the stray, then pushed the shovel under the inert body. I could see no damage on the matted head. I was terrified that the cat was not dead, just knocked unconscious, and would spring up any moment, come at me hissing and full of vengeance. But when I lifted the cat, it flopped like a dead thing, and I was suddenly struck with a bad smell, a trail of defecation that had sprayed from the cat when it died. I had expected blood, but hadn't expected shit. The smell sickened me. But I was happy I'd killed that disgusting cat. He was not as heavy as I thought he would be, his stiffened fur giving the impression that he had been larger than he was. But he was heavy enough. I managed to carry the cat about 10 feet away to the edge of the woods and dropped the body on top of some rotted leaves. I spent another 5 minutes digging up debris and tossing it on top of him till he was covered. It was good enough. My parents never went in the woods anyway. Climbing back into bed, shivering from the cold, I didn't think I would fall asleep again. But I did. Easily. I checked on the corpse of that stray for the next few days. It lay there, undisturbed, buzzing with flies, till one morning it was simply gone. I guessed it must have been dragged away by a coyote or a fox. Bess resumed her cat's life, coming and going from the house, and sometimes when she brushed against my ankles or purred in my lap, I imagined she was thanking me for what I had done. She had her kingdom back, and all was right with the world. After what happened with Chet the night of the party, I immediately thought about the incident with the stray cat. It gave me ideas about how I would kill him and get away with it. It seemed crucial that the body never be found. And if that was the case, then I needed to find some things out about Chet. After the party, Chet seemed to disappear for a little while, not coming out of the apartment and not visiting the house. I did see him one night. He was on the lawn, looking up at my bedroom window. I'd just turned off the light to go to bed, and that's when I saw him there, swaying a little like a tree in a breeze. He'd been watching me. I'd left the window cracked and the shade slightly up so that some air got into the room. I felt stupid and afraid, and tears pricked at my eyes, but I told myself that Chet would not make me cry again. I now knew for sure that he was simply biding his time, waiting for a good opportunity to rape and murder me. I did consider telling my mother about what had happened, but I thought she'd be on Chet's side, that she'd wonder why I was making such a big deal about it. And my father was still away with Rose, the poet, and the way that my mother sometimes talked about it late at night, it sounded as though he wasn't coming back. I asked her once while she was making a giant batch of hummus in the kitchen. Has Daddy called? Your daddy has not called, she said, spacing the words out for maximum effect. Your daddy, last I heard, has made a fool of himself in New York, so I expect we'll see him back here soon enough. You're not worried, darling, are you? No, I was just wondering. What about Chet? Did he leave? Chet? No, he's still here. Why'd you ask about him? I just hadn't seen him. I thought that maybe he'd moved out of the apartment and I could go up there again. I loved the small apartment above my mother's studio, with its whitewashed walls and huge windows. There was an old red beanbag chair that had once been in our house and been moved to the apartment. It had a small rip along its vinyl bottom and was slowly losing its little pellets of filling, but I missed it. When the apartment was empty, I'd bring books over there to read. You can still go up there. Chet won't bite. Does he have a car? Does he have a car? God, I don't think so. I don't even think he has a place to live right now besides with us. How'd he get here if he doesn't have a car? She laughed, then licked hummus off a finger. My bourgeois daughter, darling, not everyone has a car. He took a train from the city. Why are you asking so many questions about Chet? Don't you like him? No, he's gross. Huh, now you really do sound like your father. Well, whatever you two think, Chet is a real artist, and we are all doing the art world a huge favor by allowing him some space to focus this summer. Keep that in mind, Lily, that it's not all about you all the time. I had gotten what I wanted to get from my mother. Chet didn't have a car and had arrived here by train, which meant that he could easily pack up his stuff and leave for good. That made my job a whole lot easier. I began to prepare, spending time in the meadow next to the old farmhouse, gathering the largest rocks that I could carry. I also made myself visible to Chet, dragging one of the old lounge chairs out to the sunny patch of yard between the main house and the studio. I didn't want him to keep avoiding me, since it was crucial that he trust me to a certain degree. Crucial that we establish some sort of relationship. The first few days when I lay in the sun, reading, my headphones on, Chet did not make an appearance. Once or twice I thought I saw his silhouetted frame in the slatted glass door of the apartment as he watched me. But one day he wandered out to smoke a cigarette, standing on the top landing in his paint-splattered overalls, no shirt on underneath. I peered over the top of the Agatha Christie I was reading, and he nodded in my direction, raised a hand. My gut reaction was to ignore him, to not give him the pleasure of a response. But I forced myself to raise my hand and wave back. The next day, when I went to my reading spot, it was hot and muggy. The kind of day when you wake up sweaty and take a cold shower and start sweating again as soon as you get out of the shower. I pulled on my green bikini. I'd had it for 2 years, but my body hadn't developed much. It fit up top, although it was a little tight down below, where I now had hips. I pulled on a pair of shorts, ones I'd asked my mother to buy me earlier that summer. They were Madras plaid, and she said they made me look like a Kennedy. But she bought them for me anyway. I took my book and a bottle of sunscreen to the chair that faced Chet's apartment. I hated the sun, and I hated heat. I had red hair and freckly skin, so all the sun did was make my freckles darker. I slathered myself with the sunscreen, trying to remember if the high number on the bottle was a good thing or a bad thing. I kept an eye on the apartment, and pretty soon I saw Chet peering through the window. I could make out the orange tip of his cigarette winking on and off. 15 minutes passed, and I was listening to my tape of Les Mis and reading Sleeping Murder when Chet emerged with a mug of coffee, descended the studio steps, and casually wandered toward where I was lounging. "Hi there, Lily," he said, standing about 5 feet away, the already high sun lighting up the hair along his bare arms and shoulders so that he almost shimmered. He smelled like he hadn't showered in days. I said hi back.
"What are you reading?"
I started to hold up the book cover toward him dismissively, then remembered that I needed to be a little bit nice so that he wouldn't suspect anything when I came to his apartment later. "Agatha Christie," I said. "It's a Miss Marple."
"Cool,"
he said, and slurped at his coffee mug. Like everything else he owned, the mug was covered in paint.
"Things okay with you?"
he asked. I knew that what he wanted to ask was if things were okay with us. With what had happened the night he came into the room, he wanted to know if I remembered him being in there. "Yeah," I said. He rocked his head back and forth.
"It's fucking hot out here, man."
I shrugged and returned my eyes to the book. I'd done enough, and I really didn't want to talk to Chet anymore. I pretended to read, but I could feel him still studying me. Sweat had pooled where the two triangles of my bikini top met, and a single drop was inching its way down my ribcage. I willed myself not to wipe the sweat away with Chet watching, even though the unbearable progress of the drop felt as though Chet's eyes were slicing me with a razor. He took another loud sip from his mug and wandered off. My father came back. There was a lot of yelling and some tears. The Russian left, and for some time, my parents were constantly in each other's company, drinking like they used to on the unfinished back patio, listening to jazz albums. I was glad that my father was back for a few reasons, one of them being that with my parents' attention turned toward one another, I could focus on getting rid of Chet. I had set up everything perfectly in the meadow, the pile of rocks growing every day. and the rope in place down the old well. It had just become a matter of picking the perfect day, a day when no one would see me cross the front yard to where Chet was living, or see the two of us walk together into the woods. That day came on a quiet Thursday, 3 days after the return of my father. I spent the afternoon in my room rereading Crooked House and listening to the muffled sounds of my parents drinking. They'd started early, sharing a bottle of wine at lunch, then moving to the patio outside, drinking gin and listening to music. When the last record ended, a new one hadn't begun, and I heard their bedroom door thunk shut. Then laughter. I looked out my own bedroom window. It had just become dusk, the shadows from the nearby woods lengthening across the weedy yard. I knew the timing was perfect. There were no other visitors at Monk's house right then, and my parents were unlikely to emerge from their bedroom until morning. I pulled on a pair of jeans, socks, and sneakers. The no-see-ums would be out, and I didn't want them biting my ankles. I found a white tank top that I'd had for a few years. It was embroidered with a butterfly and was a little bit tight. I wanted to make sure that Chet would follow me to the meadow. I slid the little pocket knife that Grandpa Henderson had given me into my front pocket. I didn't plan on using it, but it felt good to have it pressed against my thigh. Chet was unpredictable, and I didn't want him to try and have sex with me before we got to the well. I also grabbed a small penlight from the top drawer of the bureau at the bottom of the stairs. The woods were always dark, especially at dusk. I went out the front door and down the wooden steps to the asphalt driveway. I cut across the yard, worried suddenly that the light was fading too fast. Behind the studio, the sky was streaked with flat pink clouds that looked like watery strokes of paint. Walking past my lounge chair, I caught a whiff of cigarette smoke and looked up to see Chet stepping out onto the landing. It was perfect. I wouldn't have to knock on the door or worry about being dragged into the apartment. "Hey, little Lil," he said, the words sounding slurry. I stopped and looked up at him. "Chet, can you do me a favor?" I don't think I'd ever used his name before, and the words sounded strange in my mouth, like a swear word I wasn't supposed to say. "A favor? Anything for you, my Juliet, my Rose by any other name." He put his hands over his chest. I knew he was doing that Shakespeare play, but he had it wrong. Juliet was on the balcony, and Romeo was down below. "Thanks. Can you come down here?"
"I'll be with you anon, my Juliet," he said, and flicked his cigarette in a high arc.
It landed on the driveway, showering sparks. He went back inside his apartment, and I waited. I thought I would be nervous, but I wasn't.
Chapter 5. Ted. After retrieving our luggage at Logan, I walked with Lily past the idling taxis at Terminal E and toward Central Parking. She stopped me as soon as we were alone in the dark lot. The pilot had told us that the current temperature in Boston was 54 degrees, but a whistling, litter-dispersing wind made it feel much colder. "Let's meet in 1 week," she said. "We'll pick a place. If I change my mind, I won't show up. And if you change your mind, then don't show up either. And it will be like this conversation never happened." "Okay, where should we meet?" "Name a town where you don't know anyone," she said. I thought for a moment. "Okay, how about Concord?" "Concord, Mass. or Concord, New Hampshire?" "Concord, Mass." We agreed to meet in the bar of the Concord River Inn the following Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. "I won't be shocked if you're not there," she said. "Or upset." "Ditto," I said, and we shook hands. It felt oddly formal to shake the hand of someone who had offered to help you murder your wife. Lily laughed a little, as though she felt the same way. Her hand was small in mine, and felt as frail as expensive porcelain. I resisted the urge to pull her toward me. Instead, I said, "Are you for real?" She released my hand. "You'll find out in a week." I arrived early that Saturday at the Concord River Inn. When Lily had asked me to pick a town where no one knew who I was, I'd picked Concord, and while it was true that I knew no one there, it was also true that it was a place that had played a large part in my childhood. I grew up in Middleham, about 10 miles west of Concord, and about 30 miles from Boston. Middleham is an old farming community, a sprawl of open fields and new-growth forest. In the 1970s, two extensive developments had gone in: dead-end streets named after the trees that were no longer there, and single-acre lots with cookie-cutter deckhouses, all popping up to accommodate employees from nearby Lextronics, the company where my father worked. My father, Barry, was an MIT graduate and a computer programmer when most people didn't know what a computer programmer was. He met Elaine Harris, my mother, at Lextronics, where she was a receptionist, and undoubtedly the prettiest woman he'd ever seen. I don't know for a fact that my father had never dated anyone before meeting my mother in his 30th year, but it would shock me if he had. My mother, on the other hand, had spent her 20s in an on-again, off-again relationship with a fellow Boston University grad who played professional hockey for 2 years before a knee injury ended his career. She told me once that when their relationship ended, and she realized she had wasted 8 years with a playboy type, she swore on the spot that she would find a husband who was plain and dull and reliable. And that turned out to be Barry Severson. They dated for 6 weeks, were engaged for another 6, then were married in a small ceremony in West Hartford, Connecticut, my mom's hometown. The reason that Concord became an important place for me was that my mother dreamed of moving there. Early in the marriage, she had decided she hated the isolation of Middleham and had become fixated on this particular wealthy suburb, with its gabled houses, its well-dressed housewives, its arty jewelry stores. My father got sick of hearing about it, so my mother would dress me up and take me, and sometimes my older sister as well, to lunch in Concord, often at the Concord River Inn. And afterward, we would visit shops. She would buy new outfits or jewelry, or Roquefort and Pinot Grigio, at the Concord cheese shop. It was not a surprise to either my father or me when, during my senior year at Dartford Middleham High School, Elaine left my father and moved into a rental apartment along Main Street in Concord Center. She lived there for a year before moving to California with a divorced accountant. My father, retired now, still lives in Middleham, where he spends his time creating Revolutionary War dioramas. I visit him on Thursday nights. If the weather is above 60 degrees, he cooks me a steak on his grill. If it's below 60, he makes a pot of chili. My sister visits every other year for Thanksgiving. It's the only time we see her, since she lives in Hawaii with her second husband and his 4 children. She sees my mother far more often, partly because my mother still lives in California, and partly because my mother and my sister are so much alike. I sometimes think that when the divorce happened, the family split along gender and geographical lines, my father and I staying east, my mother and sister going west. Clattering up the steps at the Concord River Inn, it was impossible to not think of my mother and me, sitting in the wallpapered dining room with our seafood Newburgh lunches, my mother sipping a Pink Lady, and me with a Pepsi with a slice of lemon. Lily and I had agreed to meet at the bar, and not the dining room. What I had forgotten was that there were 2 bars in the Rabbit's Warren of the inn, a snug L-shaped one immediately opposite the dining room, and a larger one toward the back. I chose the smaller bar, since it was empty, and from my bar stool I could watch the hallway that led toward the bar at the back. I ordered a Guinness, told myself to sip it slowly. I had no intention of getting drunk this afternoon. I had spent a lot of time with my wife in the previous week since returning from my business trip to London. Miranda was filled with ideas for furnishing the house in Maine. We had a vintage card table in our library, and she had covered it with clippings from catalogs and printouts from the internet. I tried not to think of her and Brad Daggett as she showed me item after item of things the house absolutely needed to have. I agreed to everything: the heated tile floors in all the bathrooms, the $20,000 Viking range, the indoor lap pool. And while I was agreeing, what kept me going was the knowledge that she was going to die, and I was going to be the one who made that happen. I thought about it constantly, turning the idea around in my mind like looking at a diamond from every possible perspective, looking for flaws or cracks, looking for guilt or second thoughts, and I found none. All I found was the renewed conviction that Miranda was a monster that I needed to slay. She returned to Maine on Thursday, making me promise that I would come join her on the weekend. Before leaving, she brought me to the library to show me a few more items she wanted to order from her pile of catalogs. Then she brought up an image on her cell phone, a painting she thought would be perfect for the dining room. "It's 6 feet by 9 feet," she said. "It will be perfect for the south wall." I looked at the tiny image. It appeared to be a man's head, his ears on fire. "It's a Matt Christie self-portrait," she said. "It's guaranteed to be a good investment. Look him up if you don't believe me." Then she named a ridiculous figure in a sentence that also included the word bargain. "Now think about it," I said. She did a little jump without quite leaving her feet, then kissed me. "Thank you, thank you." She pressed a hand against my crotch, running a finger along the zipper of my jeans. Despite my feelings for her, I felt myself getting hard. "When you come to Maine, I'll give you a proper thank you, okay?" she said in a lowered voice. I had a sudden urge to spin her around and bend her over the card table, the way I'd seen Brad Daggett fuck her. But I didn't trust myself. I didn't trust that I wouldn't smash her face into the catalogs or call her a cheating bitch. Instead, I told her that I probably wouldn't get to Maine till Saturday night at the earliest. She didn't seem too disappointed. After she'd packed for the long weekend, I walked her to the garage where we kept our cars. After loading up the Mini Cooper, I said to her, "I hope Brad doesn't give you any trouble up there, all that time you spend together." "What do you mean?" "He's never hit on you, has he?" She turned, a thoughtful expression on her face. "Brad? No, he's a total professional. Why, you jealous?" She delivered the line perfectly. A mixture of surprise, contemplation, and casualness. If I hadn't seen them together through the binoculars, I would never believe that there was anything going on between my wife and my contractor. The first few years I knew Miranda, I thought of her as someone whose every emotion was on the surface, someone incapable of deception. How had I been so wrong? She folded herself into the driver's seat and blew me a kiss through the window before whipping her car away through the tight channels of the garage. A sense of certitude washed over me. With those few simple words, denying her relationship with Brad, any doubt I had was erased. Lily was late, and as I slowly sipped my Guinness, I became convinced she was not going to show up. I felt a strange combination of relief and disappointment. If I never saw Lily again, my life would return to normal. Could I honestly say that I would still murder my wife without her help and her encouragement? Would I even be willing to try? If I did get away with it, what would stop Lily from coming forward, from telling the police that I drunkenly pre-confessed my crime on a transatlantic flight? No. If Lily didn't show up, then I would confront my wife, tell her I knew about the affair, and ask for a divorce. What would follow would be an eternity of legal wrangling and ritual humiliations, but I would survive. Miranda would take a lot of my money, even with the prenup, but I could always make more, and Brad would get what he deserved, my wife. But some of the disappointment I felt as I sat alone at the Concord River Inn, now convinced that I would never see Lily again, was that I was secretly hoping that part of her reason for this meeting was a romantic one. I had not been able to shake the image of her pale, beautiful face or the feel of her slender hand in mine. Maybe an affair with Lily would be the real revenge that I could unleash upon Miranda and Brad, an eye for an eye. And it had not escaped my notice that the place we had chosen for an afternoon drink was also a hotel. I could feel the presence of all those empty beds just above the half-timbered ceiling of the bar. As I'd been doing all week, I began obsessively reconstructing the night flight to Boston, the sudden appearance of a woman who wanted to help me murder my wife. I remember the evening well, despite the gin. Perfectly, in fact, line for line. But it was like recalling a slightly unreal dream. I wasn't sure I trusted the clarity of all my memories, or whether I had begun to project my own ambitions and desires onto the event. Since being home, I tried to find out information about Lily, of course. I visited Winslow College's website, found a bare-bones page that summarized the goals and accomplishments of the Winslow Archives. There were two names listed in the department, Otto Lemke, college archivist, and Lily Haywood, archivist. Each had a phone number, but their mutual email address was the same, archives@winslow.edu. I searched the web for anything else about a Lily Haywood and found that nothing seemed to relate to her. No Facebook page, no LinkedIn page, no images. I wasn't surprised. She hadn't seemed the type who would have any kind of web presence. And even if she had a web presence, I doubted that it would have shown any light on what I really wanted to know. Why does a stranger agree to help someone murder his wife? What does she get out of it? I just finished my pint when I spotted her. She was slowly walking down the crooked hallway, peering into doorways, and I spun on my stool to wave her into the bar. "You're here," she said, sounding surprised. "You're here too," I responded. "Let's go sit at one of those tables. What can I get you?" She asked for a glass of white wine. I ordered her a Sauvignon Blanc, got another Guinness for myself, and brought both glasses to the corner table she had selected. She looked as I'd remembered her, except that her long red hair was pulled back into a simple bun. As I placed her wine in front of her, she was sliding out of a gray blazer. Underneath, she was wearing a beige cardigan over a dark blue blouse. Her cheeks were flushed from the outdoors. There was a moment of awkwardness as we each took sips of our drinks, and neither of us said anything right away. "It's like a bad second date," I said, to break the ice. She laughed. "I don't think either of us expected the other one to show up." "I don't know about that. I thought that you would." "I guess that I didn't expect you to show up. I figured you woke up the following morning with a terrible hangover and a vague memory of plotting to murder your wife." "I did have a terrible hangover, but I remembered everything we talked about." "And you still want to kill her?" She said this as though she were asking me if I still wanted to order French fries, but there was amusement in her eyes, or maybe a challenge. She was testing me. "More than ever," I said. "Then I can help you, if you still want my help. That's why I came here." I watched as Lily leaned back fractionally in her chair, her eyes leaving me to look around the small bar. I followed her gaze, taking in the unvarnished wood floor and the ceiling that could not have been much higher than 7 feet. There was one other customer in the bar, a man in a suit, who had taken over my vacated stool and was drinking an Irish coffee with whipped cream on top. "Is this place okay?" I asked. "No one knows you here, right?" "I've been here before, but no. I don't know anyone in Concord." I thought of my mother, of the year that she spent living in this town. I wondered if she had frequented this bar. Was this where she came to look for a second husband? Had she met Keith Donaldson here, the divorcee who talked her into moving to California? They hadn't married, but she was still in California, with another man now. I saw her less than once a year. "You seem nervous," Lily said. "I am. Don't you think it would be strange if I wasn't nervous?" "Are you nervous about what we're planning to do? Or are you nervous about me?"
"Both.
Right now I'm wondering why you're here. Part of me thinks you're some sort of law enforcement and you're going to tape me saying how I want to murder my wife." Lily laughed. "I'm not wearing a wire. If we weren't in such a public place, I'd let you frisk me. But even if I were wearing a wire, could I even arrest you for planning to kill your wife? Wouldn't that be entrapment?" "Probably. I suppose I could just say that I was trying to seduce you by talking about killing my wife."
"That would be a first."
"Are you?
What, trying to seduce you?"
"Yes."
"Are we still playing the game from the plane? Absolute truth?"
"Then I won't lie and say that I haven't thought about you in that way. But no, everything I said about my wife and how I feel about the situation is true. I was honest with you on the plane.
And I was honest with you. I want to help."
"I believe you," I said. "It's just that I don't entirely understand your motives. I understand what I get from what we're planning." "A quick divorce," Lily said, and took a small sip of her wine. "Yes, a very quick divorce. But you wonder what I get out of it."
"I do. That's what I'd like to know."
"I thought you might be wondering about that," she said. "I'd have been worried a little if you hadn't." She fixed her intense eyes on me. "Remember when I was telling you how
I felt about murder, how I believe that it's not as immoral as everyone thinks. I truly believe that. People make a big deal of the sanctity of life, but there's so much life in this world. And when someone abuses his power, or, as Miranda did, abuses your love for her, that person deserves to die. It sounds like an extreme punishment, but I don't think of it that way. Everyone has a full life, even if it ends soon. All lives are complete experiences. Do you know the T.S. Eliot quote? Which one? The moment of the rose and the moment of the yew tree are of equal duration. I know it's not justification for murder, but I think it underscores how so many people think that all humans deserve a long life, when the truth is that any life at all is probably more than any of us deserves. I think most people fetishize life to the point of allowing others to take advantage of them. Sorry, I'm off track here. When I met you in the airport lounge, and then we talked on the plane, you chose to tell me that you fantasized about killing your wife, and that allowed me to tell you about my philosophies of murder. That's it, really. I like talking with you, and if you are serious about killing Miranda, then I will help you in any way I can. I had watched Lily, in the course of her short speech, become briefly passionate, her face pushing toward me like a sun worshiper, tilting toward the sun to get the most of its rays. Then I had watched her retreat again, as though she had revealed too much. She turned the stem of her wine glass between her fingers. I wondered briefly if she was insane, and as soon as I had that thought, I decided to plunge forward anyway. I knew this feeling well. It was the way I'd made enormous sums of money, by taking foolish risks. "I want to do this," I said, "and I want you to help me."
"I will."
She took another sip of her wine, the light from a brass wall sconce above her making the glass glow and reflecting onto her pale face. She looked more beautiful, I thought, with the hair pulled back, but also more severe. She reminded me of models in some of the catalogs my wife received. Catalogs full of tall, rich-looking girls in tweeds and jeans, posing next to horses, or in front of country houses made of stone. The models from those catalogs were never smiling. "I have one question," I said. "Exactly how many people have you killed?" I wanted to phrase it as a joke to give her a way out of the question, but I also wanted to know if she had practiced what she preached. "I'm not going to answer that," she said, "but only because we don't know each other well enough yet. But I promise you that after your wife is dead, I'll tell you everything you want to know. We won't have any secrets. It's something I look forward to." Her face softened as she said this, and I felt as though there were an implied promise of sex thrumming in the quiet room. My glass was empty. "Have you been thinking about it? About how it should be done?" I asked. "I have, a lot," she said, and slid her wine glass away from her so that it lined up with my pint glass. "We have a huge advantage, and that advantage is me. I can help you, and no one knows that we've ever met. I'm an invisible accomplice. I could provide you with an alibi, and since no one knows we know each other, the police would trust me. We have zero connection, you and I, and there are other ways I could help you as well. I don't expect you to do the killing for me." "No, I know. It's just that, with me helping you, we can greatly reduce the chances of getting caught. That's the hardest part. Committing the crime is easy. People do that all the time. But most people don't get away with it."
"So how do we get away with it?"
"The way to commit murder and not get caught is to hide the body so well that no one will ever find it. If there was never a murder, then there can't be a murderer. But there are many ways to hide a body. You can leave a body out in the open, but make it look like the opposite of what happened actually happened. That's what needs to happen with Miranda, because if she goes missing, the police will keep looking until they find her. When the police look at her body, it needs to tell a story that has nothing to do with you. It needs to lead them down a road where you'll never be. I have a question for you. How do you feel about Brad Daggett?"
"What do you mean?"
"Do you have an opinion on whether he should live or die?"
"I do have an opinion.
I want him to die." "Good," she said. "That's going to make this a whole lot easier."
Chapter 6. Lily. When Chet came back out of the apartment and joined me in the yard, I was glad that he had put a shirt on underneath his overalls. He still smelled bad, like apple cider that had turned sour. I told him that I had found something in the meadow on the other side of the woods and needed his help. I told him that I would have asked my father, but he was busy. Chet grunted in solidarity, as though he knew that my parents were reuniting in their bedroom. We entered the narrow band of pine forest that separated my parents' property from the derelict property next door. "Have you been over to the meadow?" I asked. He was behind me, stumbling slightly, holding up a forearm as though branches might suddenly lash at his face. "I took a walk down to the old railway tracks when I first got here," he said. The tracks were in the opposite direction of where we were going. "The meadow's cool," I said. "It's behind an old farm that no one lives in anymore. I go there all the time."
"How far is it?"
"Just through the woods here." We clambered over the toppled stone wall that lined the edge of the woods. A ghostly light from the low sun turned the meadow's scattered wildflowers into electric colors. The sky above was transforming from pink to dark purple.
"It's beautiful,"
Chet said, and I felt a brief, unreasonable annoyance that he was sharing my meadow. "Over here." I began to walk toward the well.
"You too. You're beautiful too."
I forced myself to turn and look at him.
"Sorry," he said. I told myself, "But God, just look at you. You don't even know how beautiful you are, do you, little Lil? You don't mind, do you? Just, if I look."
He swayed a little, one hand rubbing at his unruly beard. "It's okay, but I need you to help me first. There's an old well, and there's something down there attached to a rope, and I can't pull it up."
"Cool. Let's go take a look. How'd you find a well out here?"
I ignored his question and led him across the meadow. I'd known about the well for years. It wasn't too deep. With a flashlight, you could see the bottom. Nothing down there but pieces of rock and sometimes standing water if it had rained. I wasn't even sure it was initially a well, so much as a deep hole. Maybe the beginning of a well that had failed. I had come across it when I was probably 9 years old, running back and forth across the meadow. One of my footfalls had made a hollow wooden sound, and I pulled away dry yellow weeds to discover the well cover, a rotted wooden square that looked like it had been put there just to keep someone like me from falling in. It barely covered the rectangular well hole and was easily pulled off. The sides of the well were lined with layered rock. I didn't have a flashlight with me then, so I dropped rocks down to judge its depth. They hit something solid after only a second or so I knew it wasn't that deep. At the time, I thought maybe it was a hiding place for treasure or a clue to a larger mystery. I raced back to get a flashlight, but I ended up disappointed. The well hole was just that, a hole in the ground, collapsing in on itself. When I showed Chet the well, he said,
"Hey, look at that. When did you find this?"
"About a week ago," I lied. I spotted the rope first and then pulled off the well cover. "It isn't deep, I think, but I can't pull the rope up myself. There's something heavy on the other end." Putting the rope down the well had been part of my preparation. I had found the rope, a weathered-looking length in the cellar of our house, along with an old metal stake, and had brought both to the meadow days ago. I tied one end of the rope tightly around one of the larger rocks I'd unearthed from the meadow, and lowered that end down the well, then staked the other end deep into the earth. I didn't think it looked particularly genuine, but it didn't matter. All I needed was for Chet to want to find out what was on the other end of that rope. That morning, I'd gone into my parents' bathroom and found something in the cabinet, a small tub labeled pomade. I brought it with me earlier to the well and rubbed the hair goop all over the first few feet of the rope, making it hard to hold. I had been worried that the rope would be too easy to pull up and that Chet could manage it from a standing position. I needed him to kneel in front of the well hole. As it turned out, I didn't need to worry. Chet, acting like an excited little boy, dropped to his knees in front of the well and took hold of the rope.
Ugh, what's on this?
I don't know, I said. Some sort of muck. He put his fingers to his nose and smelled.
It doesn't smell natural. Smells like shampoo.
Maybe someone doesn't want us to pull it up. I had moved so that I was standing directly behind him. He craned his neck to look at me. I could see one of his wet, puffy eyes stare at my chest. My skin tightened, goosebumps breaking out along my arms.
You like butterflies?
He asked, his eyes still on the embroidered front of my tank top. I guess, I said, and involuntarily shifted backward. I felt a sudden revulsion, plus anger at myself, that I had brought this man with me to my secret meadow. Of course he wouldn't care what was down the well. Of course, all he cared about was sex. He'd want to stick his penis in me before pulling up the rope. I'd been foolish. I tried to think of something to say, but my brain had emptied out and my mouth had gone dry. But then Chet asked,
You didn't tell your parents about this?
No, I said. They'd just get mad at me. And if they found anything cool down there, they probably wouldn't let me keep it.
Might as well take a look,
he said, and turned his eyes back toward the well hole.
Now, what's in it for me if we find a treasure chest down there?
He was doing what I hoped he would do, working his way down the rope to get a better grip. He ducked his head partway into the hole and shifted forward on his knees. Don't fall in, I said. It was something I'd planned on saying, to make him feel more safe.
How far down is it?
Not that far, I think. Chet made a couple of whooping sounds into the well that echoed back up. Let me hold on to you. I had planned this as well, wanting to get him used to having my hands on his back. I didn't want to just try and push him in and have him rear back suddenly and fight me. I grabbed the fabric of his overalls with both fists, just as he said,
I got it. It's coming up.
I conjured all the strength I had and shoved as hard as I could. He tried to lift his head, but it was in the hole, and he banged the back of it on one of the layered stones that lined the well. His whole body tilted forward, falling, and for a moment, I thought I was going to go down the well with him, a possibility that hadn't even occurred to me. But somehow, he managed to jack his legs out and stop his forward progress. I rolled to the side, listening to his surprised scream. One of his heavy boots was jammed between two of the flat rocks that lined the well entrance.
Jesus!
He yelled. Then,
Help me!
I heard a clattering sound as something struck the bottom of the well. His glasses, I thought. I stood. One of my fingernails had snagged on his overalls and torn. I only noticed because I had reflexively shaken my hand and flecks of blood had spattered me in the face.
Lily, God help me!
I crouched near where his foot was lodged between the rocks. It was pretty clear that it wasn't going to hold him, and that he would fall anyway, but I took hold of the edge of the worn sole and shoved it forward. Chet made a grunting sound, then I heard the sound of scraping, followed by a loud crash as he hit the bottom of the well. I expected to hear him yell some more, but he was quiet. There was only the sound of falling dirt and debris still pattering down the well, plus two crows cawing at each other on the other side of the meadow. I pulled the penlight I had brought out of my back pocket and twisted it so it turned on. It didn't produce a very powerful beam, but it would be strong enough for me to see into the darkness of the well. I thought my hands would be shaky, but they weren't. I felt focused and lost in my own brain, the way I felt when I was reading a good book and the afternoon disappeared. I peered over the edge and pointed the beam of the flashlight down toward the bottom. I was so sure that Chet would survive the fall and would be begging me to help him up. I had been prepared for it. Instead, he lay still at the bottom of the well, on his back, his legs against the side, and his neck at a funny angle. I stared at him for a while. My penlight beam was weak, and the well was filled with shifting dust, but it didn't look like he was moving. Then I saw an almost unnoticeable shift and heard a low sigh that could have come from Chet or could have come from something settling in the disturbed well. I stood and walked the few feet to my low pile of heavy rocks that I'd been collecting. I selected the largest, a jagged hunk of gray stone with a vein of quartz running through it. I had to carry it with both arms, so I gripped the penlight in my teeth. Waddling like a penguin, I came back to the well, straddled it, and bent at the waist. Pointing the penlight into the darkness, I lined up the rock as best I could and dropped it straight down toward Chet's head. I didn't watch the rock after I dropped it, but I heard the noise it made when it struck Chet's head. It was a sound like a watermelon cracking open. If Chet had still been alive after the fall, he wasn't anymore. My arms ached from carrying the rock, and I stayed crouched for a moment. A crow watched me from his perch on a dying maple tree on the outskirts of the meadow. I wondered if he could smell the death in the air, and thought that he probably could. He dipped his head, ruffled his black wings. I felt like he was welcoming me to a special world. After turning the penlight off and returning it to my pocket, I pulled the stake out of the ground, dropping it and the greased-up rope into the well. Then I walked back and forth from my pile to the well and dropped about 6 more large rocks down toward Chet. I would cover him more later, but figured that it wouldn't hurt to get a head start on the process. I would have kept going, but the light in the sky was fading, the clouds now purple and dark, the meadow and the surrounding woods losing their color, fading into grainy variations of gray. My initial plan had been to return to the apartment above the studio and start packing up Chet's things, bring them back through the woods to the well and dump them in. Then I would cover everything over with rocks and recover the well whole. But as I walked back through the blackness of the woods, my penlight's beam only carving out a small patch of forest floor in front of me, I decided that I could pack up Chet's things now and move them to the well in the early morning. I knew that my parents would sleep late. I was very familiar with the small apartment above the studio. It was one of my favorite places when it was empty. But I hadn't seen it since Chet had moved in at the beginning of the summer. I had been worried that he would have a lot of stuff that I would need to pack up, but he didn't. He was still living out of a large army green duffel bag that was spread open by the single bed. I began to search the place using the penlight, then realized I could simply turn the lamp on. On the off chance that either of my parents looked out their bedroom window toward the studio, they would hardly be surprised to see a light on in Chet's apartment. In fact, they'd be more surprised if there wasn't a light. The lamp cast dim yellow light across the whitewashed walls and the wide, bare planks of the floor. There was very little furniture in the studio apartment, just my beloved beanbag chair, looking deflated, and 2 upholstered chairs, each with rips in its fabric, foam coming out. The chair with the pastel-sprigged print was another of my favorite reading spots. I was glad to see that Chet had used it to stack some books. It meant he hadn't been sitting in it. There were some clothes scattered around the cot, a couple of t-shirts and a pair of white underpants. I used one of the t-shirts to scoop the underwear off the floor and put both in the duffel. A stale, itchy smell of body odor came out of the half-filled bag. But the apartment didn't smell as bad as I thought it might, mainly turpentine and ash. In the center of the floor was a coffee can nearly filled to the brim with cigarette butts. I picked it up and tried to think where to put it, then realized I could dump it in the duffel. Chet would not be wearing his clothes anymore. From the bathroom, I grabbed Chet's toothbrush, a nearly empty tube of toothpaste, a white crystal stone in some packaging that said it was a deodorant, a bright green bottle of Pert. I left behind the sliver of hairy soap in the dish. From the kitchen, really a corner with a sink, a few cabinets, and an electric hot plate, I grabbed two packages of ramen noodles and a large plastic bottle of Popoff vodka. I dumped the vodka down the sink and left the bottle in one of the cabinets. I suddenly worried that I was leaving my fingerprints all over the apartment, that I should be wearing gloves. But I would have time tomorrow to wipe things down. Besides, if things went the way I thought they would, then no one would suspect that Chet had been killed. It would simply look as though he had taken off. It was hard to imagine that anyone would miss him. After filling the duffel, I zipped it closed and lifted it, making sure I would be able to carry it in the morning. It was heavy, but manageable. All that was left of Chet's in the apartment were his painting supplies. There were four canvases, three that were leaning against the wall, faced so that I couldn't see what they looked like. The fourth canvas was still on the easel. It was in the early stages, just a few blocks of color over some pencil marks, but I could tell that it was of the swimming pool at the back of the house, and that a figure had been sketched in the corner of the pool. There were no details, but I knew it was me. It was a pretty small canvas, not a lot bigger than a normal TV screen. I took it off the easel and twisted it so that its fragile wood frame snapped. Then I put it on the floor and stacked the other canvases on top of it. I barely looked at them, but they all seemed like finished paintings. Abstract splotches of color with, here and there, something that resembled a figure. I could have painted them. The easel was Chet's, since I was pretty sure there had never been an easel in the apartment. It was small, with three telescoped legs supporting it. I collapsed it and folded it into itself till it was the size of a small briefcase, a block of stained wood with a handle to carry it. I added it to the pile of paintings. I looked around the room, thinking that I had gotten everything. Even if something was left behind, it would merely look as though Chet had left it himself. My finger throbbed where I'd torn at the nail. I looked at it closely. The blood had clotted, turning brown and sticky, and I didn't think that I had splattered anything in the apartment. Suddenly, I wanted to get out of there and be back in my bedroom. And I was hungry. Unless my parents had gotten to it, there was leftover shepherd's pie in the fridge. I set my alarm for 6 the next morning, but when my owl-shaped clock hoo-hooed, I was already awake, out of bed, and half-dressed. I'd slept some, but it was the kind of sleep where you are aware of every squeak and click and scrape that old houses make, where you think you haven't slept at all, and then realize that the strange thoughts in your head were actual dreams, and that the pulled curtain is glowing slightly, that dawn has broken. It took 3 trips to bring everything from the apartment to the well. I brought the duffel bag first, and that was the hardest. I had to drag it for a while when it got too heavy to carry. The meadow was covered with a cool dew that dampened the bottoms of my jeans. I peered down into the well before dropping the duffel in. Chet was still there, buried under the rocks I'd dropped on him. A few clumsy black flies batted around his body. On the next trip, I brought the three larger canvases. They weren't heavy, but they were awkward, and I had to break one of them to get it down the well. On the last trip, I brought the small backpacker easel and the painting that Chet had started, the one of me in my pool. After dropping them down the well, I grabbed the rest of the rocks I'd been unearthing and dropped those in. It was satisfying, especially as I watched all evidence of Chet disappear under a pile of rocks. I had used an old rusty trowel to pry some of the rocks loose. It was still in the meadow, and I used it to dig up clumps of dirt, dumping them down the well until it looked as though there was nothing down there except dirt and rocks. I knew it wasn't perfect, but I was satisfied. The last thing I did before leaving the meadow was to drop the rusty trowel down into the well, then replace the cover. Using my already filthy fingers, I swept some of the long, dried-out grass across the cover to try and camouflage it. I circled the area before leaving it, an eye on the ground to make sure that nothing had been left behind. But there was nothing, not even a cigarette butt. Chet was gone from the world. The morning was quiet, just the rising hum of bugs and the cawing crows that were the true owners of this meadow. I cawed back at them, like I sometimes did, and wondered what they thought of me. Back at the house, I showered for a long time, scrubbing at my fingers to get at the last of the dirt. The hot water humming over my body made me feel both powerful and safe at the same time. When my mother opened the bathroom door and said my name, I jumped and nearly fell, my foot squelching along the bottom of the shower. "What's wrong?" I said. "Nothing, darling. Daddy and I were wondering if you wanted to go get breakfast at Shady's." "Okay," I said. "When?" "Soon as you're out of that shower." We used to go get Shady's Diner more often. It was my father's favorite, and probably my favorite, too, especially for breakfast. I got the French toast with a side of extra crispy bacon. My parents sat across from me in the booth, their shoulders touching, even sharing a fruit bowl to go with my dad's corned beef hash and my mom's omelet. Thoughts about Chet crept into my mind all during breakfast. Then they would disappear when one of my parents said something to make me laugh, or when I was thinking about how good my food was. My stomach felt like a hollow bowl that I could fill forever. "You're hungry, Lily," my mother said.
"She's a growing girl, almost a woman," said my father.
Breakfast was a good time, even when my parents ruined it by asking me again if I wanted to skip another grade. Some of my teachers had recommended it at the end of the school year, and I had already said no at the beginning of the summer. My mother had kept bringing it up, so I punished her by refusing to go to art camp in July. I knew that the 2 weeks when I was away was something she looked forward to. I was surprised that the subject came up again, but it didn't last long, and it didn't entirely ruin breakfast. I didn't hear anything about Chet for a week and began to worry, wondering if it was unnatural that I hadn't said anything about it. So one day during lunch, my father, nowhere to be found, and my mother in a silent mood, I asked what happened to Chet. "Chet left. Didn't you know that?" "Where'd he go?" "God, Lily, I don't know. Someone else's couch, I guess. He never said goodbye, ungrateful prick." That afternoon, I wandered out to the apartment. It looked as though my mother or father had been in and straightened it out a little.
The cot had been stripped of sheets, and the trash bucket in the kitchen area was emptied. I sat on my chair for a moment, even though I didn't have a book. The windows were open, and a cool breeze, the first we'd had for a while, came through into the apartment. I'd been waiting for two things since killing Chet. Waiting to get caught, and waiting to feel bad. Neither had happened yet, and I knew that neither would.